Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The new year traditionally brings a sense of renewal and hope, but in California, the level of destruction and loss we've collectively experienced in just the first weeks of 2023 is heartbreaking and extraordinary. The wave of powerful storms earlier this month damaged homes, businesses, and claimed the lives of at least 22 people throughout the state. And just as the storms eased, all too familiar tragedies descended upon us. So far this month, at least 25 people have been killed in mass shootings in California, from the Bay Area to the Central Valley and Los Angeles. The weight of these heavy events and the media coverage that follows can be a lot to bear, even for those who aren't directly connected to them. We're going to spend some time this morning to learn more about these indirect traumas and what coping mechanisms and resources are out there for those who may be suffering from secondary or collective trauma. Joining us is Dr. Njali Amin, a clinical psychologist and president of the Asian American Psychological Association. Dr. Amin, welcome to Insight. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'd just like to start off by asking how you've been processing the recent events, not only as a psychologist, but also someone who's based in Los Angeles, where one of the mass shootings in our state unfolded.
Well, I would say it's been a pretty tough week. I've been just trying to take time to connect with my colleagues and talk about what's happening, to acknowledge how I'm feeling in response to the events, and also just trying to be a support to those around me.
Given that mass violence and natural disasters are, of course, traumatic events for those directly impacted, but what can be the impact of these types of events on people who may not be directly impacted, but in some way feel a personal connection?
There are a lot of ways that exposure to acts of violence, natural disasters, or other trauma can impact our mental well-being in a negative way. We often refer to this as secondary trauma, and it's a process that we see a lot with first responders, medical professionals, those who are routinely exposed to trauma. But research shows us that exposure to traumatic events through the media can lead the observer to experience a similar response, including anxiety, difficulty coping, feelings of helplessness, and even immense fear. It's really normal in these situations for folks to feel powerless, to experience strong emotions.
When it comes to these terms, secondary and collective trauma, are they interchangeable or are they different?
Secondary trauma often refers to something maybe an individual is experiencing, and collective trauma is something we think about as maybe something a community as a whole is experiencing. When we think about the recent shootings, we want to think about how the Asian American community at large might be holding collective trauma in response to some of these events.
Given that you are the president of the Asian American Psychological Association, what conversations have you been having with your colleagues?
Honestly, we've just been talking about how we've been feeling, how we've been responding, what we can do together to support our community and to enable a process of perseverance and resilience in the wake of these tragedies.
How do you recommend when talking about collective trauma? I mean, we're talking about a community, but, you know, it also can be strangers within a community. What is the best way to heal from collective trauma?
So, you know, I'm a really strong believer in connecting to the community around us. And I think in moments like this, it's been proven time and time again how valuable and healing it is to connect with our community. You know, the systems we have in place are not built well enough to help us through the complexity of these moments. And so the healing we need often comes from community support. So I encourage folks to think about how you can connect with others, whether near or far, attending the vigils, calling up the people you care about, talking, dialoguing, expressing with others. You know, when we gather in community, it really gives us the opportunity to connect with our bodies through things such as collective breathing, with our hearts through individual reflection, and with one another through space, and even just sharing and being silent together.
How should people talk about what's happened this week and in the first, 3 weeks of the year?
Well, you know, I think it starts with the willingness to have difficult conversations, acknowledging within ourselves what we might be feeling emotionally, saying the hard stuff and sharing our stories. You know, oftentimes we may feel a sense of shame or guilt, grief, and those are emotions that are very powerful, and we often maybe might feel inclined to hide them from others. But when we talk about our experiences, when we share them, we take away the power that those emotions can have. So we have to just keep promoting conversations on the difficult topics that come up in all of our spaces in response to these events.
And it can feel relentless. And given that you also teach and you train psychology trainees, medical residents, and other healthcare professionals about, you know, how to process, you know, these traumas that can feel relentless, coupled with years of the pandemic, how has the prevalence of, you know, mass shootings, and we're talking about natural disasters, but also, you know, 3+ years of a pandemic and getting a front row seat to that and the trauma that follows, how has that impacted your teaching and your training?
Very much so. You know, I think the unfortunate reality is the seeming regularity with which collective trauma is occurring in the world around us. And one of the things we really notice within the mental health field is this is a time where our providers, our healers are going through the same things, the same traumas that the folks are who they're helping. And so that definitely takes a toll. And a lot of what I've been incorporating into my teaching is just coming back to the basics, making sure you're checking in with yourself on a daily basis, asking yourself, how are you today? What are you feeling? What do you need? And just really coming back to that act of naming and acknowledging our emotions. You know, an important goal with some of these basic kind of processes is agency, which is the thing that's so often taken from us in and after moments of traumatic loss. Mm.
Given that the AAPI community in California and also just across the country has seen an alarming rise in hate crimes, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, I think there were reported incidents increasing by over 170% between 2020 and 2021. But given that the suspects and the majority of the victims in both the mass shootings in Monterey Park and Half Moon Bay are of Asian descent, how does that impact the anxiety level of a community that's already been on edge the last few years?
Yeah, well, I think this is incredibly relevant when we consider what you just referenced, right? The past 2 to 3 years for the Asian American community and the sharp rise in anti-Asian hate. You know, we're not stranger to this. This has been a part of our history since the early 1800s. But when I think about the broad array of diasporas that often make up our Asian American community, I often consider the meaning of safety, and I see it as a common thread. So for a lot of us, our stories, our family histories, they involve taking risk, fear, vulnerability, all of which heighten and prioritize safety and survival in our lives. And as I said before, many of our AAPI communities have trauma in their histories. So when we experience this additional trauma, it only exacerbates the fear and the need to implement safety. And that can be incredibly taxing on the body, both individually and collectively. To be in a sustained, heightened sense of fear is really detrimental to our physical, emotional, and spiritual health.
Do you think the past couple years and the isolation and even the stigma that's attached to the pandemic is contributing to a rise in violence that we've been seeing in just the few weeks of the year?
You know, I think what these events truly shed light on is just the issue of gun violence in America. And as many of my colleagues have pointed out, the reality is that we live in a country where a majority of us can readily gain access to these weapons, legally or illegally. And for Asian Americans and other minoritized communities, the violence that's occurred both within and against us is really rooted in a long history of oppression, white supremacy, and misogyny. And when we consider the health and well-being of our communities, we have to also integrate conversations on gun violence.
Hmm. And also adding to that is, you know, a historical stigma of surrounding mental health and taking care of your mental health.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we know that the AANHPI community uses mental health services the least of all racial ethnic groups in the US. And when we do seek help, we often only do so when our symptoms are the most severe or at their worst. But I don't think that means we're not engaging in healing or processing at all. And when we think about just the diversity within our community, that healing and coping may look different, in that we may be accessing more of our ancestral wisdoms and traditions than we are utilizing traditional Western mental health services. You know, a lot of the traditional Western ways of addressing mental health don't often take into account our distinct cultures, our languages, our ways of healing, and that adds additional barriers to utilizing those types of services.
Right. Those barriers and trauma are generational. I mean, many people, they come here because they are refugees, they're fleeing war, they're trying to figure out a new culture, a new language, as well as, you know, discrimination as well. And these get compounded and layered as even as it continues through generations, going back generations, correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, when we leave that trauma untreated, it wreaks havoc on our lives. And even when we think we've put it away or we're functioning and carrying on in spite of it, it will find a way to permeate our well-being. And this has the potential to impact generations, creating what you just talked about, intergenerational trauma and grief. So addressing our trauma is essential to our healing. It's what allows us to remain healthy, to endure in the long term.
How do you recommend younger generations, if they want to heal this generational trauma, how do they do so? Where do they begin?
You know, I think it's important to just consider, again, the willingness to have those difficult conversations. And it really starts individually with us, and then we can sort of connect with our community. So, you know, again, can I check in with myself on a regular basis? How am I doing? What am I feeling and holding? What do I need? And then once we've processed our emotion, we can more easily come to a space of taking action. And I recommend that folks connect with the things within their reach to start small. We can't always solve the bigger problems of the world, but we can still do the things that align us with our values and that keep us in touch with the person that we want to be.
Given that, you know, these big issues, I mean, they can feel overwhelming. And the media coverage surrounding mass shootings and natural disasters and other really trying and painful events can be triggering. How do you recommend people process the news and the coverage?
Well, my number one recommendation is to take a break from the news and the media. You know, we're not built to take in a constant stream of stress and anxiety. Our bodies and our minds just can't handle that. So we have to find time to disconnect, to connect with our present moment, and to do so on a consistent basis. So I often challenge my clients, my trainees, to ask themselves, can I turn off the screen, the alerts, the notifications, even just for a couple minutes today? And if I can do 2 minutes today, can I work up to 5 minutes next week? And when we're consistent with this, it helps us build the habit and it turns this into a lifelong practice. Mm-hmm.
What would you like to say changed in the way these traumatic events are covered in a way that perhaps could be more thoughtful and even reduce harm?
Yeah, you know, I think that we're seeing a little bit of a shift in this already. And I think just shifting focus to the community rather than trying to uncover the complexities of the perpetrator, why it was done, what was done, what are the motives. But, you know, what can be so powerful for folks to do is to just provide space for those who are impacted to acknowledge and process the impact of these events. You know, we often find ourselves in spaces that ignore the existence of trauma, but those spaces don't need to be purposed in that way. They can be radical spaces of possibility. And we can ask ourselves, you know, what can I do for my colleague, my student, my friend, my community member to promote their healing?
When it comes to resources, what is available to help yourself or to help a loved one cope with, you know, maybe some distress or anxiety that they're feeling due to the events over the last month?
There are a lot of resources. And I think that's one of the wonderful things that I've seen come up as conversations about mental health have gained traction. So I always refer folks to the Crisis Lifeline 988, which is a wonderful resource if you're finding yourself in high distress and you need support. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has a number of really great resources. And I always encourage folks to check out the National Coalition of Asian Pacific Americans, which is a coalition of 38 national Asian Pacific American organizations around the country. It's based in DC, but it represents the interests of the greater Asian American, Native Hawaiian, Pacific Islander community within the states. And they do a lot of wonderful work to help our communities.
Finally, Dr. Amin, how do you care for your own mental health?
That's a great question. I try really hard just to stay present in the moment. You know, trauma has a way of keeping us stuck in the past and the future. And so my simple goal each day is to just do my daily check-in, to be present in the moment, to ground, to connect with the things that feel meaningful for me, and to rest. Rest is a form of resistance, and I often encourage it with folks.
Thank you so much for the advice and your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Unjali Amin is a clinical psychologist and president of the Asian American Psychological Association, explaining secondary and collective trauma as well as resources available to help. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.